quantum non-locality and then the talk says on small thermal machines at the quantum level, and also in weak values and other foundational topics. So,
okay. Well, thank you. Yeah. So, yes, so today I'll talk about some of the recent work I've been doing in Bristol with my supervisor, which is Sandu Popescu, as well as Noah Linden and Nicola Brunner, who's a postdoc in Bristol. And so, just to start off by giving you an outline of what I'll talk to you about. So I'd like to start, obviously, with an introduction to these ideas and try and give you some motivation about why we've been looking at these. I then want to talk to you about what I'll call this kind of basic functioning principle, which is the idea which we use to construct kind of these small machines. I then want to show you how I can use this principle to build, to give you a very simple model of a refrigerator at the quantum level. So I want to show you that this really behaves as a fridge, and I'll talk to you about analyzing the efficiency, so one of the obviously the key property of kind of all of these thermal machines. I then want to go one step further and say how we were able to take these ideas from the refrigerator and then model instead an engine and the difference between these. And I'd like to finish up by telling you that actually the end result of this work is now we believe that we have a rather nice kind of unified view of thermal machines at this level. So to start with, obviously, if we go all the way back to the beginning of thermodynamics, if the work of Carnot, so people were interested in turning heat into work, and the insight that Carnot had was he said, let's not look at a specific physical machine, but let's abstract and let's view kind of model-independent machines where I have some source of heat, where I extract, I convert this into work, and then in general now we know that we have to dump some heat into another reservoir. And what Carnot realized is that there's actually a fundamental limitation on the efficiency of all thermal machines, independent of any of their properties. So this is the second law of thermodynamics. And the important point that he realized was that actually machines become maximally efficient when the machine becomes reversible. And as a kind of the example that we know, for example, if we have a gas in a piston and I transition through two isotherms and two adiabatics, then I know that this is a reversible cycle, and therefore I can, if I run this system very slowly, I can achieve the Carnot efficiency. And so now the question that we'd like to ask, the overall question is, what happens if we don't go to completely abstract machines, but what if we start to talk about some of the properties of the machine? And specifically, given the title of my talk, you can imagine that the property of the machine we're interested in here is the size. And we'd like to know is what happens to machines if I try and specify that they have some given size, and specifically what happens if I try and make them as small as possible. And the first question we had, or the first question we'd like to ask is, could there be a minimum size? Could it be the case that if I start shrinking the size of my system far enough, could it be the case that there's just some size below which there's no sense even to have a thermal machine? And the second question then is, could it be the case that the efficiency of a machine is, or well, more generally, could it be that the performance of the machine is somehow a function of the size? So could it be the case that if I'm small, I can have a some thermal machine, but necessarily I'm inefficient? And one reason why we were thinking about this is because when you think of a gas in a piston, then what you do is you transition through infinitely many states in your system. And the question we have is, could it be really important that we have so many states here? And if I really only have a small, finite number of states, does this really make a difference? So these are the questions we'd like to ask. Okay, so the first point to stress is that I've said I want to talk about size, so let me be more precise by what I'm going to use as my measure of size here. So I'm going to, already I'm as you guess, I'm talking about quantum mechanics, and so I want to measure the size of my machine by the dimension of the Hilbert space of the machine. And one additional requirement I have, which is why I've said here small and self-contained, is I have to make sure that this counting that I'm using, I really want this to be a fair counting. And what I mean by this is that if I just count the degrees in my machine, but I allow myself time-dependent interactions, then what I'm really doing here is I'm not counting fairly. Because this, if I have time-dependent interactions, then T is, for me, an external parameter, which implies I have some external control, which implies I have more degrees of freedom somewhere in the background that I'm manipulating. And so therefore it means that I'm not actually counting everything that's constituting my machine. So what I really want is I want a system whereby the stationary behavior with a time-independent interaction, it should behave as a thermal machine. And so therefore, all I want to allow myself is an incoherent interaction with a bath. So I know that I have to have an open system and I have to have some interaction because I want to talk about thermal machines. And I need a source of free energy. And all I'm going to allow myself is to have two baths at different temperatures to do this. So this was our goal. And so now, how do we go about achieving this? So I want to start off with the first machine, which I said we'll look at, which is somehow the simplest one to try and consider, which is to consider a refrigerator. And let me ask the question of how can I cool a qubit? So I want my machine to be small, and so for the moment, let me also assume that I'm going to cool a small system, so just the smallest system I can imagine, a qubit. And so imagine that this is a qubit I want to cool, and it has some free Hamiltonian setting up my energy levels, and it's at some temperature T. And so just a reminder, what I mean by this is I mean that the density matrix is a Boltzmannian, and so I have this exponentially smaller probability of being in the excited state relative to the ground state. And now what I'd like to do is I'd like to bring in another system, which will be my machine, and I'd like to use this to try and cool down this qubit. So let me start again with the smallest system I can consider. Let me imagine I have here another qubit, and I'll start off for the moment, just for simplicity, at the same temperature. And so what kind of interaction can I introduce between these two? So clearly there's one interaction I can introduce which conserves the energy, and so I could have an interaction whereby I excite the atom here and I disexcite the atom here. But obviously I know that therefore the inverse is also possible. So I have an interaction which is able to swap energy between these two systems. And so now if I'm going to cool this system, which is the same as saying that I increase the population of the ground state, the question we have is what is the different rate between the two interactions? So what is the rate of the green versus the rate of the orange? And the rate will be given by the probability of being in the state that I'm connected to. So my orange one, I'm going to have, it's the probability of being in the state 0, 1, which is important relative to the state 1, 0. And so if I have these two temperatures the same, then what I find is that these two populations are obviously the same. So my transition in one direction is exactly the probability of the transition in one direction is exactly the same as the probability in the other direction, and so therefore what I assume is that I will achieve nothing. So what I'd really like to have is that the probability of this guy being in the excited state and this one being in the ground state should be larger than the other one. But how do I achieve this? The only parameter I'm allowed to play with is this T prime, the temperature of my machine. And so there's only one way I can achieve this in this picture, and that's if I take T prime to be smaller than T. And so in which case, this is then just completely a triviality because I put a cold system next to my qubit and I managed to cool it down. So actually there's nothing I can do if I just have myself a qubit. So now the question is, if I go to a larger system, can I do something smarter than this? So can I buy it, or in other words, is there a way of me biasing this interaction without simply just using a colder system here? So let me consider again the system I want to cool, and now let me take a pair of qubits. And now, as you see, I'm going to choose these energy levels so that they're not the same. I have E1, E2, and E3. And let me choose the levels such that the difference between this level and this level exactly matches the level here. And so I'll start off again, as I did previously, with the three at the same temperature. And let me introduce the interaction. There's one interaction which conserves the energy. So this is a three-body interaction where I disexcite these two at the while I excite this one going the other way. And so again, now what I'd like to do is I'd like to do exactly what I did before. I'd like to try and bias this interaction. And now, as you'd expect, given that these three are at the same temperature at the moment, and given that they have the same energy, it's clear that these two states have the same population, and so obviously nothing happens. But now I want, again, to try and bias the interaction. And so what this means is I'd like the probability to be in the state 101 should be larger than the probability to be in the state 010.
Are these meant to be infinitely weak interactions?
I will take them to be infinitely weak, yes. Yes, that's correct. Okay, so the question is now, how can I play with these two temperatures, which I now have access to get this bias in the right direction? And now I can actually do what I'd like. If I take this qubit now to be in contact with a hotter environment than the other two, then what I find is that the bias is in the right direction. So now the situation is not trivial because I introduce a hotter bath, and this has the effect of cooling down the qubit. So really, it seems that this acts as I'd like it to act. And so this was somehow where we started, but I'd like to now actually try and explain to you a bit clearer what's really going on here. Why is it the case that by adding in this hotter qubit, I appear to be able to bias this interaction in the right direction? And the way to do this is to consider my first system, but now let me not draw the other two systems side by side, but let me draw them as some composite system for the moment. So I just draw them together. And what does the interaction look like when I draw it like this? Well, simply the interaction is between these two levels in the middle and my qubit. So my system just thinks it's interacting with these. So now what I'd like to do is I'd like to take seriously the idea that all I care about is this pair of levels, and I want to consider this somehow as a virtual qubit. And so the important question now is, given that I have this virtual qubit, I'd like to ask, what is this virtual temperature? What is the temperature associated to this transition inside this virtual qubit? And what do I know? So I know that the probability over the excited state over the probability of the ground state should be exponential of the energy over the temperature. And I know what the ratio of these two is. If the two were in thermal state, it's simply this factor here. And so this allows me simply to write this virtual temperature of my transition. And what do I find? I find exactly that when I take T double prime to be hotter than T prime, as I've set things up, then this virtual temperature becomes colder than the other temperatures in my system. So really what's going on here is I'm able to engineer a cold interaction is somehow hiding in my system, and then my qubit is now trying to thermalize with this cold interaction. So this is somehow the intuition of what we're trying to do here. And so what I'd like to do now is to show you that this intuition can be made precise if I give you an exact model, a very simple exact model. And so
you still have E2 and E1 and E3 related as before.
Yeah, sorry. So I always have this condition that E2 is E3 plus E1, so that this transition I have, this interaction, is one which conserves energy. So let me now just consider the more general situation where instead of having these two at the same temperature, I'll just keep them at different temperatures just to keep it the most general setting I can have. And so now I've said that these three are at temperatures, so I have to be precise by what this means. So what I mean is that there's some dissipative dynamics acting on these three qubits, and the dissipator I'll use is somehow a very simple kind of model of dissipation. So what I imagine is that with probability pi delta t in time delta t, each of these qubits is replaced by some thermal state of its bath. And with probability 1 minus pi delta t, it's left the same. So this is somehow a collisional model whereby I come and I interact, I instantly thermalize, And this happens with some small probability per unit time PI. And on top of this, obviously I have the interaction Hamiltonian now, which couples the states 0, 1, 0 and 1, 0, 1. And so if I put these two ingredients together, I can derive very simply a master equation for the dynamics of this open system. So I get that the rate of change of my state has the standard unitary dynamics generated by the free Hamiltonian in the interaction. And now I have this sum of dissipative terms acting on each of the three qubits. So this is the equation I would like to now study. And there are a couple of subtle points about this equation which I just want to mention quickly. So the first one to note is that whenever I've talked about temperature, I've implicitly been referring to the temperature relative to the free Hamiltonian of these three systems. And so, in other words, as you said, this means that I'm really considering now that the interaction strength is really infinitely small compared to the free Hamiltonian. And this is because I don't want this interaction to entangle my eigenstates. I want to be able to talk about three independent systems and therefore have a meaningful notion of what the temperature of these individual systems is. And the second point is that there's no coupling introduced into my system between the interaction and the dissipation. So in general, the fact that I have this interaction and the fact that I have some dynamics with each qubit with the bath means that you could get a kind of an effective dissipation on each qubit due to the other qubit. And this we're assuming is negligible, which means that, in other words, these corrections, which would be of order G times P, I'm assuming that these corrections are negligible. So in other words, that PI is the same order of G, so that this is somehow a second order effect. And as long as I'm careful, I can make sure that these terms won't make any difference.
Not obvious to me, this master equation is completely dissipative.
It is possible to write this in the standard Lindblad form. So this dissipator that I've written, it amounts to somehow the standard dissipator you see plus some additional dephasing. So actually the coherence dies faster than it needs to given this collisional model. I could take it to be slightly weaker. But I agree that it's not obvious, it's completely positive, but you can show that it really is.
Sorry, Paul. So I run some 1, 2, 3, right? So there is something. So you are taking that this interaction with the bath is never entangling the three systems, because you are saying that rho always goes in a tensor product of Ti.
So I assume that my interaction always it just it kills any entanglement between the system because it literally just cuts and replaces by some state of the bath.
Okay, so this master equation does that?
This master equation is exactly analogous to adding in the resetting of each qubit with the interaction. Okay.
So you have just the one bath at temperature T on the outside, is that correct?
The I is referring to each of the three systems. So each of the I've taken a shorthand. So I mean that in time delta T, there's a probability that one bath, each of the baths may get thermalized with some probability PI. So I guess I should be more careful here. This should be 1 minus the sum of the PI. I mean, in time delta T, with PI, the first one gets thermalized. With P2, the second one gets thermalized. With P3, the third one. And then with probability 1 minus the sum, nothing happens to any of them. And I assume that there's no double collisions here. So PI is sufficiently small.
And how should I think about, what is the physical situation you have in mind such that this is the appropriate model of that physical situation?
So the picture we have is that there's a timescale under which lots of particles from my bath each pass by, and there's an interaction with each one. And if I coarse grain over this timescale, what I'll find is that it has this property of resetting. So I have a bath which is filled with lots of particles, each in a thermal state, and I coarse grain over lots of interactions. So there is a microscopic kind of picture which you can give, which gives exactly this kind of dynamics. So this is somehow what we have. Or in other words, you say that there's this instantaneous, my particle is literally just replaced by one of the bath with some probability. So a kind of semi-classical reset model. This is what we had in mind. Just because this is somehow a very simple dissipator to work with, this is why we chose to study this one.
Subsystem has its own depth, its own temperature. Is that
yes, correct. Yeah. So this is what I'm trying to convey in this picture. So this one is constantly in contact with a bath at T1. This one is constantly in contact with a bath at T2, and this one at a T3.
One more than you started out.
So previously I had three, but I kept two at the same temperature. And now I'm just the most general situation.
Start at the very beginning when you showed us the heat engine. There were just two temperatures.
Okay. Yes. I'll show you the analogous picture in a moment when I come to talk about the efficiency, and then I think it'll be clear the question you're asking. Okay. So now I'd like to show you that this master equation can act as a refrigerator. So what I will be looking for is I want to find some stationary solution of this master equation. So some rho s, which satisfies now this equation. And what's the property I'd like to have? I'd like to find that if I look at the reduced density matrix of the third particle in this stationary state, and I calculate its temperature, I would like to find that this stationary temperature is smaller than its environmental temperature. So I'm able to maintain this qubit at a temperature which is away from its temperature of its bath. And if I can find this to be the case, then this is when I'll say that this is acting as a refrigerator. Itaka?
Yeah. It is possible to calculate it sort of stationary temperature. Is it because so like equilibrium state, like equilibrium system, that it's like independent systems, it is possible to calculate this sort of independent Hamiltonian to update the temperature. But it's a stationary system. It seems to be it seems to be calculated.
Sorry.
The temperatures from sort of independent Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
But just a sort of two sort of qubit, three qubit, so the three body interaction. You mean to sort of this system?
Yes.
It's sort of used to matrix, so that it seems to be impossible to calculate as a define the temperatures.
So this is why I said I was working in this regime where my interaction is very small. So I'm assuming that it's a good approximation to treat my systems as being unentangled, and therefore when I take the trace,
yeah.
I'm still in the energy eigenstates, and therefore I can calculate the population in this state, and from this I'll define the temperature. You'll see in a second. So because this equation is sufficiently simple, and because the dimension is sufficiently low, it turns out that you can really solve this with all the parameters held free.
Sorry, I missed. What's meant by rho s 3?
So I mean that I calculate rho s, and now I look at the reduced density matrix of the third particle. And then I ask, what is the temperature of that state?
So that presumes that marginal will indeed be a thermal state.
It does.
Okay.
And
so you're going to prove that, and then you're going to show that its temperature is T3.
So what I actually find, that this stationary state is always diagonal in the same basis as tau, in the energy eigen basis, and that what it has is it has a shift from its equilibrium populations, which is this product P3, so the rate at which I'm thermalized times some constant gamma, and gamma is somehow a complicated function of all the parameters. So it wasn't obvious that I should get a diagonal state, but I always find a diagonal state. And somehow for a two-level system, I just use the fact that I know that the two populations are related. So if I have two levels, I can calculate whether or not this is I can always define a temperature from this.
Will it sometimes be a negative temperature?
Possibly. Later on, I'll come to this. There's this possibility. So this is the form of the solution that we find, where the population shifted, and everything is due to this gamma. And so the important property that we find of this gamma is that it's the difference between these are now the thermal equilibrium populations, between the two states connected via the Hamiltonian. So the state 101 and 010, the thermal populations, it turns out gamma is proportional to these two. And given this, it's easy to see that this number here is actually then just proportional to e to the minus e3 over t virtual, as I defined it earlier, minus e to the minus e3 over t3. And so what I find, what I should mention is that you see that it's the sine of gamma now, which is actually important here. Because if gamma is positive, then I'll find that I have an increased population in the ground state. Whereas if gamma is negative, I find a decreased population. So when gamma is positive, I find that this is acting as a fridge. And when it's negative, I find it's heating it up. So it's not working.
Sorry, and those P's are the probabilities?
These are the populations of these two states at if they were in thermal states. So in the absence of interaction.
I'm sorry, a bit mixed up. What? Don't you want T3 to have a lot in zero state?
I do, indeed.
Or system three, but. If gamma is positive, doesn't it mean it has more in the one state? Although I'm just mixed up. Like, isn't number three, don't you want lots of 0, 1, 0?
What I'd like is that for this state, I would like the population to increase in the ground state, which means yeah. Gamma should be positive. Because then I, as a, well, given my convention for sigma z, that it's 1, 1, it's 0, 0 minus 1, 1. Okay, so given that I find this gamma is proportional to the difference between these two numbers, what I conclude, therefore, is that in this solution, it has the property that the temperature that I achieve in my stationary state is less than its environmental temperature, exactly when the virtual transition, the virtual temperature, is less than the temperature of my bath. So in other words, the analogy seems to be exact. If I generate a temperature which is lower, then I'm able to cool this system down. And the exact temperature that I achieve, obviously this depends upon gamma, but the point is that there's no gap here. It really coincides perfectly. And the one important property, which may become relevant later, if I assume that the interaction here becomes very weak with this bath, so I isolate this qubit I'm trying to cool more and more, what I find is that in the limit, when the bath interaction goes to zero, what I actually achieve is I find that the stationary temperature really goes to the virtual temperature. So this is a nice thing. So it really tries to, it really wants to thermalize with this virtual transition, and it really achieves it in the limit where this becomes infinitely weak. So in other words, what we have is from this very simple model, we find that with two qubits, it's really possible to cool down a third system. So we can really go, we can really have machines which become almost arbitrarily small. And I don't want to talk about it today because it's a bit messy, but it turns out that you can replace this pair of qubits by a single Q-trit, and you can still do this same trick as long as you allow the Q-trit to interact with two different baths. And then this is possible still to construct such a machine. But it's much easier to think about the two-qubit system when you want to think about these machines.
Or can TV be smaller than T2?
Can
TV
be smaller than
T2?
Yes.
Okay.
In general, TV will be smaller than the pair T1 and T2.
Okay.
So that's exactly. So I choose it such that really that this temperature. So in general, I take T3 to be the coldest temperature in the problem. And even then, I'm able to cool it down relative to this temperature of its bath. So it's not that I'm trying to play any tricks here. I really want to try and get this to be cold. So the second question we had after we showed that we were able to construct such a machine is, sorry.
Do you need the third bath at all?
Actually,
is it helping you to drive it to equilibrium, or do you?
No, that as I said, so I can really, if I want to, I can neglect the third bath and I can consider an isolated system. And I find that if I put an isolated system in contact with this machine, that I'll still cool it down to some temperature. So, yeah.
So you just had it for symmetry or something?
Well, we had it because it seemed the most natural problem to try and, I always imagine I have a bath which I'm extracting heat from. So one way of viewing this is to say that this cold qubit is extracting heat from its bath. which is the view I now need to take for the efficiency. So if I, one way of thinking about this system is that it's something like this. So I have my qubit, which is now extracting heat from a cold bath. And to do this, I'm extracting heat from a hot bath, and I'm dumping some heat into a room temperature bath. So this is somehow the classical, if you like, kind of abstract picture of what this machine really looks like. And so what we'd like to do is now calculate the efficiency of such a machine. And so the efficiency for a machine like this is going to be Q3 over Q1. So it's how much can I extract from the cold bath over how much do I extract from the hot bath. And so if you go through the standard textbook analysis of saying that this should be a reversible machine, what you find is that the Carnot efficiency for such a machine has this form. It's 1 minus T2 over T1 divided by T2 over T3 minus T1. So this just comes from the entropy production. And so the question is now is, what is the efficiency of this machine relative to this Carnot efficiency? And so what I need to calculate now is I now need to calculate what are the heats which I am taking from my bath. And so the heats are defined as the change in the energy of my system due to the interaction with the bath. So in my master equation, I had these three terms, the dissipator for each of the three qubits. So the dissipator here, there should be a stationary state, sorry. So in the stationary state, I look at the change in the energy due to the dissipator, and this will be the rate of change of heat. So this is the standard definition. And so, again, given the simple form of my stationary, of this analytic solution that we find, I can give you the form for this dq by dt, and we find that all three of them have a simple form. They're simply equal to gamma times the energy of the level, so gamma times E1 or gamma times E2. And actually, I've been a bit careless here. There should be a minus sign for the room, the temperature at T2, because it goes in the other direction. I forgot to write this down. And so this seems slightly what I then am led to conclude using this formula, that the efficiency of my machine then comes out simply as E3 over E1. And this at first sight seems rather contradictory, because it seems that my efficiency is a constant which doesn't depend upon any of the parameters in my problem, and it seems like I can even trivially violate the Carnot efficiency if I just play with my energy levels. But this is obviously just an illusion. And why is it an illusion? Well, if you remember, what are the conditions that this system actually acts as a refrigerator? Well, this was given that the virtual temperature should be less than T3. And if you recall the definition of the virtual temperature, you'll see that it actually depends upon the energy levels and it depends upon the temperatures. And as always, I have this condition between the three energies in my problem. So if I substitute these two relations into this condition that the virtual temperature should be less than the temperature of the environment of the cold qubit, what do I find? I find that E3 over E1 is actually bounded by a function of the temperatures. And rather surprisingly, this function happens to coincide with the function for my Carnot efficiency. And so what I actually observe is that I can take my quantum efficiency is exactly bounded by the Carnot efficiency. And so if I take the virtual temperature to be arbitrarily close to the temperature of the environment of the system I'd like to cool down, then what I find is that I get arbitrarily close to the Carnot efficiency. And actually, in the limit where TV equals T3, this was the limit where the gamma vanished, and this is the limit where I achieve Carnot, and this is somehow what I expect, because even in a classical system, when I have a gas in a piston, if I really want to achieve the Carnot efficiency, I have to drive my system infinitely slowly. So it's not surprising that my currents vanish exactly in the limit where I find that I'm closest to Carnot efficiency. So what we seem to conclude is that these simple model of a refrigerator, one is able to be small, and also it appears that the size imposes no constraints on the efficiency, because I can all, I can get all the way down to the Carnot efficiency. So this was, we were very pleased with this, and this was the first bit of work we did. And obviously this is one type of thermal machine, but the next question we had, which we were stuck on for a while, was how to use this to actually go on to then create an engine. And it wasn't obvious to us that just because we were able to give a construction for a refrigerator, whether or not this implied the existence of an engine. And we wondered if it could still be the case that small engines couldn't be produced. And the reason for this is because what we didn't understand for a long time is what exactly we wanted to mean by work in this context. So why we started with the refrigerator was because we could talk about temperatures and we could talk about heat, which were ideas which we felt that we understood a bit better. But when it came to work, we were scratching our head for a while. And it turns out that the answer to our question actually, again, goes all the way back to Carnot. And there's a nice quote in Carnot's paper, which we found, where he says that motive power, which is what he called work, is the useful effect that a motor is capable of producing. And then he said, crucially, this effect can always be likened to the elevation of a weight to a certain height. So Carnot says that as long as you can lift a weight, then this is the same thing as being able to produce work. So somehow the obvious answer in hindsight, but this is then what we're going to now use as our definition of work. And so the question is, what then is the analog of lifting a weight? So we say that, imagine I have some collection of energy levels, I have some ladder, and can I move somehow my weight up this ladder? So can I increase the energy of this system indefinitely? And if I can do this, then I'm going to claim that this is the same as producing work.
The thing on the right is a quantum mechanical system
again.
With more levels.
Yeah, so imagine I have a harmonic oscillator as a simple example, and I try and continuously pump energy into this harmonic oscillator. Or actually, for simplicity, it doesn't make any difference. We took it just to be an unbounded above and below. It turns out that it just simplified our calculation. So what we'd now like to do is show you how I can use this to give a model engine. So as I said, I have some collection of energy levels. And I want to do as before. I want to consider, again, a pair of qubits. I won't try and do this with a single qubit. I'll start where I know works. And again, I take exactly the same restriction on the energy levels. And I know I put these two again. Let me start off considering them at some temperatures. And the interaction I can now put between the systems is I can have an interaction where this one excites, this one disexcites, and I jump up one rung on the ladder. And so in general, I have an interaction between jumping up and jumping down combined with this, with my two qubits. And so what is it I would like to achieve? So as before, now I'd like to say that the probability of raising the weight should be lower than the probability of lowering the weight, because I know in general I can't get rid of this, also this interaction where I lower the weight. And so now what will the condition be? So it's exactly the green interaction which causes the weight to raise. And so if I find that the thermal population to be in the state 0,1 is larger than the probability to be in 1,0, so that where the green transition occurs, this now appears to be my condition for this to raise the weight. And so using the definitions of the thermal states, I find that this is just e to the minus E2 over T2 should be larger than e to the minus E1 over T1. Or analogously, what I find then is that E1 over T1 is larger than E2 over T2. So now I find that as long as T2 is sufficiently bigger than T1, then it appears that this should allow me to lift the weight. And the signature I'm going to look for, so I want to calculate the average energy of the weight, and I want to look at its derivative in time. And as long as this is at some constant which is positive and greater than zero, then it's clear that I'm increasing the energy of my weight, and so therefore I'm going to be raising it.
Putting energy into the system on the right-hand side, in effect.
Yes.
What is that difference? So now you're talking about doing work on it, giving it energy is doing work on it. Whereas before, might we just interpret it as raising its temperature, or am I missing something? I was wondering what sort of was being doing work on it and giving it heat.
So if I was just now trying to, if I had this collection and I was trying to change its temperature, then I know that it's still always going to be the case that I'll have the largest probability to be in the ground state if I have any given temperature. So somehow the difference here is that I really want this stationary current going up.
You don't want it to be in a thermal state.
I don't want it to be in a thermal state. I really want to, it to
so,
be in
so,
a...
So it's essential that it's not in a thermal state.
Yes, this is somehow the characteristic of my system, that I'm keeping it away from a thermal... I guess I agree that it becomes slightly... This is why we it took us a while to think about what we mean to do work on a system. And this is this definition that as long as we're continuously pumping energy into this system, then we're...
But how close can it be to a thermal state? I mean, in any state. It's not really close enough.
So actually, I can get, what I'll find is that I get far away from a thermal state in general. And the reason I say that, I think I'll clarify shortly.
If you say the energy is bounded, unbounded below, then it can't be anywhere near.
That's true, but I can also do this, for example, with a harmonic oscillator where I have a... Where I have
so
a
this might be a good
okay.
case where you're avoiding...
I see what you're saying. So you're saying that I'm avoiding it because I have it unbounded, but I could also, if I wanted to, I could take this bounded at the bottom and I'd still find I'm far from a thermal state, even in this system.
Right. It's just especially clear in this case.
Okay. Okay. That's a good point. Okay.
I'm quite understanding why the state of that system is important. I would have thought that the definition of work would be something like the effective operation that's implemented on the third system ought to be a unitary, which conserves the entropy and raises the energy, rather than some operation which raises the energy while adding entropy. And I would have expected to say, well, no matter what the initial state is, the question is whether the effective operation on that system is one or the other. So what am I missing?
So I see your point here. So for us, we're saying that even if we are pumping some entropy into the state, I know that there's no way I could have this stationary, I could not increase the temperature just by putting heat into my system. I still couldn't raise this. And effectively what's happening here is that my weight is undergoing effectively a random walk somehow, if I want to think classically. So I agree that the one, what you would like, and this is what we thought initially, is that you want the dynamics to be unitary, but for us, there's no way of achieving this. So this we're taking to be is the work, because we're still increasing the weights. I mean, we're still raising the weights. So our claim is that we must be doing work on it, because otherwise, how do you raise this weight?
Yeah. So if you imagine that your multilevel system is bounded from above,
okay.
Well, then in this case, you can always well, you have a maximum energy that you can pump into the system, but then you can always achieve a state with entropy zero, namely you population one in the high energy state.
Well, so actually here, with this model, I won't achieve this. I'll never, if I bound this from above using what I've said and using what Rob said, the fact that I'm pumping entropy into my system, it's not the case that I find myself perfectly in the excited state.
Yeah, so I was wondering whether you might not pump entropy. Why it's essential that you're pumping entropy here?
Well, necessarily we do, because this is because of the fact that I'm adding uncertainty to this chain, because at each point I can go up and down. So I definitely if I start off with a well-defined position for the weight, then it's spreading in time.
Is that since I don't achieve the maximum entropy state, that is the Gibbs state, what you achieve, even if you pump entropy, but you achieve a state that has a lower entropy than the Gibbs state, then that's why you produce work?
Yes. So actually, the answer, and maybe raising ahead, is what I find is that I get something like a an inverse Gibbs state, but maybe I'll come to this in a minute. This is what we seem to observe. So I agree that this definition we've taken may be open to some questions, but maybe it's best if I proceed, and then I guess I'm quite happy to discuss this afterwards at length. It would be great to get some insight into these questions.
Are you saying the entropy of the system always increases, or it might increase?
So at the moment, that we're still I'm still in the process of trying to figure out the details of this entropy, because this is quite recent work, so there are many questions which I'm still exploring. So hopefully it wouldn't. I mean, hopefully it doesn't always increase, but the intuition at the moment is that it looks like it does.
Sorry, I don't want to belabor the point, just to clarify the discussion. So your definition of work is using that machine to raise the energy of that third system by an amount E3, regardless of what happens to its entropy.
Yes.
That doesn't matter in the way you define it.
Because we said that as long as you can raise the weight, and as long as I find a stationary state where this weight is being continuously raised, then we said that this is what we will say is work. Because even if I have some uncertainty, I'll still be able to use this later on to on another system to do some work. So this is a subtle point, I guess. So let me continue. So the equation, the system now, the master equation I wish to solve is very similar. So I am really assuming now that my weight is isolated, so I only have the two dissipative terms, and now my interaction Hamiltonian is more complicated. And the point is that, again, given that this equation is relatively simple, we're able to solve exactly for the quantity which we wanted. And what we're able to show is that in the long time limit, the rate of change of the average energy of the weight has some constant factor at the front, which is positive. And then I have a term which is again equal to the thermal equilibrium difference between the two populations in my engine. So it has a very similar form. And the reason why I say that in this long time behavior is because I do expect that initially I'll have some transient behavior due to however I choose my initial state. But I assume that if I wait long enough, that this initial behavior will die away and I'll be left with this behavior. And so given that the rate of change is again proportional to the difference, when is it that this is positive? So when is it that I raise the weight? Well, again, it turns out it's exactly when the condition which I initially wanted to be satisfied is satisfied. So again, the correspondence seems to be quite clean. And so what we see is that using at least our definition, this system acts as an engine. And so now what I'd like to do is I'd like to bring this back now and consider this in relation to how I started with this basic principle, and with the fridge, everything was in terms of the virtual temperature. And here it seems that I'm doing things in a slightly different way, so let me try and unify these two viewpoints. So I consider my weight again, and I draw my system as one composite system. And again, the interaction is only between these pair of levels and the weight. And so let me ask again, what is the virtual qubit looking like, and what is its temperature when I'm able to lift this weight? And given the condition which I want to satisfy to lift the weight, this is exactly the same using the definition of the virtual temperature of finding that this temperature is negative. So in other words, what I find, this is exactly the same as saying that inside my virtual qubit, I have a population inversion. And once I see that I have a population inversion, I then start to understand why this weight is trying to be lifted. Because I have my qubit with an inversion, have my system which is trying to thermalize with it, and it's unbounded from above. So effectively, it means that it always increases the energy. And actually, the thing which is rather interesting is that if I bound this from above and below, so I take some finite system of levels, and I place this at some inverse temperature, and I ask what is the stationary state, given that this is isolated, then what I find is that the stationary state is exactly a Boltzmannian, but it's a Boltzmannian with this inverse temperature. So I really find that I have this tail, so I really never get everything into the excited state. I really find myself bounded away from, there's always a finite probability of being away. And so then this now is, it's really something we only realized very recently, and this is something which we're quite keen to really try and explore, to see if there's any weight in this idea that the essence of being able to do work at the quantum level is really related to being able to have a system which has an inversion in it. And so all I've done here is I've taken two different temperatures and I was able to produce an inversion, which obviously is something it's very intuitive that I can't do. If I only have one temperature, I'll never be able to create a stationary inversion. And so there's one upshot of this idea, which is not controversial, in that this is somehow gives us a very unified view of the different thermal machines. And so what do I mean by this? So I mean that if I have my two temperatures and I start off where the T2 is less than T1, where now there is an asymmetry because I've assumed that E2 is larger than E1, then what I find is that my virtual temperature is colder than the T2, which was already the coldest, and I get a refrigerator. Now, if I take T2 to be larger than T1, but less than this number, E2 over E1 times T1, then I find that the virtual temperature is hotter than T2, and actually I can use this as a heat pump, which is a machine I didn't talk about, where I'm able just to pump heat into a bath. And finally, when I take this limit, when I take T2 to be sufficiently larger than T1, what I find is that my virtual temperature becomes negative and I have a heat engine. So somehow everything is now viewed in one, everything appears unified, and the picture is like this. So the orange line is my T virtual, and these two purple lines are the two temperatures I have in my system, T1 and T2. And so as you see, in this region, I'm colder than either of my two temperatures, and then immediately I flip to be hotter, so I become a pump, and then finally here I now become a heat engine when I have this negative temperature. So we'd like to say that this is a rather nice way of looking at thermal machines. We see that there really was only one machine that we can use, and it just depends upon how we function this machine as to what we're able to achieve. And so we have some open questions now, which I'd like to mention a few about this, specifically about this idea relating to the negative temperatures or the population inversion. So the first one is really we want to know if there's any weight in this idea that work is somehow related to inversion. And somehow we have the hope here is that could it be the case if we analyze it carefully, for example, when I have my gas in a piston, could it be that there is some sense in saying that there's an inversion hiding in the system somewhere? This would somehow be a goal. And also all the works where you have time-dependent Hamiltonians, it's not obvious yet, but it would be very nice to understand whether or not there's some relation to inversion. The second question we have is therefore related, I guess, to your question, Robin, about this idea that there is somehow now a quality of work in that I see that if I have a very weak inversion, so I have a very large negative temperature, that when I have a stationary state, I really don't get very close to the top. I can have a large probability of being away, but it's only if the case if I have a very good inversion will I get almost everything in the most excited state. So is there somehow this notion that there's different types of work now? Is there some meaning to this? And the third one, which I think would be quite interesting, is its relation to the third law of thermodynamics, if what I've done above is correct. And the reason I say this is because the third law of thermodynamics tells me about my approach towards absolute zero, which for qubits is the same as saying getting everything in the ground state. And so now I have the inverse problem of trying to get everything into the excited state. So could it be the case that there's somehow an analog here telling me how difficult it is to get everything into the excited state? So this is also something we'd be really excited to look at presently. And so I'd like to end on this note. And so just quickly to conclude, so what I've done is I've showed that in some sense there's no limit on the size of thermal machines, because I gave you a simple model for really a system containing only 2 qubits, showing you that there's also appears to be no complementarity between the size and efficiency. And I didn't talk about the efficiency of the engine, but you can see, well, the calculation is really straightforward, and you find that the same result holds. You can show it achieves the Carnot efficiency. What I want to claim is that work is somehow intimately related now to population inversion, at least at the quantum level. And I'd like to believe that what we have is we have a rather nice unified view of these thermal machines at the quantum level. So thank you.
Is there anything especially quantum about this effect? Could it be the same thing that is classical?
Yes. We don't really use coherence in this at all, so that this is somehow a very classical model, and for every quantum model you can write down just a classical kind of with some probability I flip and with some probability I thermalize model, and it behaves effectively exactly the same. The only one difference that we found is that there you can have a regime where you get a kind of a Zeno effect if you allow your thermalizations to become quite a bit stronger than your interaction, your interaction Hamiltonian, then you'll find that this seems to degrade, which you wouldn't expect classically, but it goes in the wrong direction. So I don't think we use any quantum here.
So the quantum effect makes it worse for the quantum case.
So in this regime, quantum actually makes it worse, yes, because you run into Zeno type paradoxes, because you measure so you're thermalized so quickly that you just stop your system evolving effectively. So
can you imagine anything interesting happening, say, entangled system or any kind of quantum regime?
So when we started, we didn't know if entanglement would be crucial or important, and as we've studied them, it doesn't really appear to play a role, especially in our model. And at the moment, we don't have any good ideas about how maybe to try and utilize entanglement. But this would be an interesting question.
Well, you stole much of my question. But one thing, that for this to work, you need a G to be small, right?
Yes.
When you set the trace, that you would still have an eigenstate. So you're basically not including the effects of entanglement. So what if you did? I mean,
so then it means we have to be much more careful with our model then, if we wanted to go and look at these effects, because we'd have to really be careful to make sure that we give the right dissipative dynamics for this equation to be consistent. Because I said as soon as G becomes larger, then I expect there to be additional terms in my dissipator due to the fact that even though I act locally with one dissipator, the fact that my system is interacting strongly means that I get effective dissipation on the other qubits. So
it seems to me this is going to make the efficiency worse. Is that right? Because you've got other systems that could leak into it. Do you have any intuition for what
I guess, yeah. So at the moment, we seem not to have any kind of, even though my qubits sit next to each other, I don't have any irreversible flow between the bars. So I agree that as soon as they start, if it would seem to me if they interact any stronger, then I may get irreversibility due to the fact that they see that they have 2 bars next to each other. So maybe this would be my immediate intuition.
And that's what I was thinking. It's gonna.
Yeah, it seems to be worse.
Yeah, make it worse.
And so one thing I didn't mention here, but the important point is that even though we take G and P both to be very small, the effect we get only depends upon the ratio G over P. So I get a large effect. Even for vanishingly small G and P, I can have a quite a large effect. So this was an important property which I failed to mention here.
You should be able to do it perturbatively in G, right? Just
yes.
Calculate leading order corrections just to maintain.
Yes, that's true. This we haven't yet started to do.
So you described a situation where you extract work even the resource of two heat baths at different temperatures,
yes,
and two qubits with the appropriate energy level split.
Yes.
So a different resource from which you could extract work could be a single heat bath together with a system about which you have some information.
Okay.
So it could have two degenerate levels, and you might know that it's definitely in one of those. So this is the Sillard engine.
Okay.
And so the question is, can you understand the work that you can extract from a Sillard engine and a single heat bath in terms of population inversion?
Again, this is definitely one of the questions that I'm very keen to start looking at. I mean, all of these kind of questions, if this idea that we have has any weight, then I believe it should be able to say something about the situation. But as yet, we've really only just began to start trying to think about all of these problems. So this is definitely one that to add to the list. I'd be very interested to look at.
Is there a connection to the Mach-Zehr thermal?
Yes.
And also, this is the second thing. Your schemes seem to be relevant to the cavity cooling system.
Is it?
Cavity cooling. Do you know it's the cavity cooling?
I can't. I don't know much about cavity cooling at all.
We have sort of cavity, and also atom. Just the cavity cooling system is sort of inserting sort of light, to sort of modulate this sort of photon field. It's sort of modulating. So it's sort of cavity loss is a question. In that case, the atom temperature can be decreasing. This is the cavity cooling system.
Okay.
It seems to be relevant to your world, I think.
Okay.
And also, this system is experimentally demonstrated. Yes.
Okay, I'd have to look at it and see. And as far as trying to create some kind of Maxwell daemon,
yes.
It's not obvious to me how to do that at the moment. I'm not sure if there's any connection here.
Another kind of paradigm I'm thinking about is instead of an inversion, you've introduced this interesting idea of an inversion as the essence, but also some sort of cycle is usually essential in all of these thermal machines. Can you relate those two? It's kind of a vague question, but
so
where is the cycle here and how is it related to the inversion?
So I got pointed to some references yesterday by Rob about this idea of passivity in systems, whereby if you have a system is called passive, effectively if it has no inversion, and means also that you can get no work out in a cycle. So it seems that maybe people have realized this idea of inversion in cycles before us, so I need to now explore this. But the reason why we didn't want to cycle is because obviously if I have a cycle, as far as I can see, that implies that I have a time. I mean, I need to know that the time of this cycle. So for me, this was somehow an external parameter, which is exactly why we wanted to focus on stationary behavior. So here we're able to move. So somehow there's a cycle hidden in the fact that I have a stationary behavior. Just like in a Carnot machine, I assume that I extract work at some rate, and I extract heat from my bath at some rate. This is somehow the picture we have in our mind. So I'm not sure I can see the cycles directly.
I didn't quite understand. Are you saying because you set some parameters in year zero that you don't have cycles? Or are you just saying you don't know how to see the cycle, look at the and see the cycle?
At the moment, I really don't know how to see the cycles in what I've done. This is one of the questions that we're still trying to make sense of.
So this question. So I want to understand what is the relationship between the specificity of the population inversion and the fact that you wanted to study really the smallest possible machine. In this sense, because your virtual machine is a two-level system, therefore you can say, oh, I have a population inversion, but maybe something more general. What you have is something that is not the maximum entropy state.
Okay.
So if you make a machine that is not just two levels,
I see.
But it's some levels.
And I generate.
And then any state that is not a big state that's, that contains some information, not the maximum entropy, you can use this information to make work.
Okay.
So it's not population inversion, just that you have a.
It's just crazy.
Some non-maximum entropy state that you use to make.
So you're saying if I put two, could it be the case if I put two larger thermal states together, I get more interesting states than simply inverted thermal states as virtual states inside my system?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that you can raise a weight by using a system that is not maximum entropy, which in a two-level system consists with inversion population, but it's
but
more general than that.
Okay.
Yeah. For two levels, you only have two probabilities, so you can always interpret the temperature in by fitting a Boltzmann distribution to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you have more levels, then
well, so this is the thing.
So long as it's not Boltzmann, then you can.
So one thing that we somehow we missed in the work initially is that if I take my my two qubits, which act as my say fridge, for example, or engine, and I really put an n level system next to it, which is perfectly isolated. Then what I'll find is that the stationary solution in this scenario is actually a Boltzmann on the n-level system, because the Boltzmann is the state which has exactly the inversion on every pair of levels. Mm-hmm. So somehow, even though I've been talking about qubits here, it appears that I really can, I can actually call arbitrary systems and they go to the state I expect. So it's enough to have a, it's enough to equate this as a, to have the ratio here is enough to say I have the Boltzmannian. So. I'm not sure. It seems that this
that makes sense as long as this the right hand interactions to thermalize what is there. I guess that just makes sense since bring two systems together and thermal equilibrium.
But it's not obvious to me that just by having two levels, which I, as you say, I can artificially claim is a, I can always claim as long as it is a Boltzmannian just by.
Yep.
Because it's not obvious to me why when I put say a three level system that I should find the exponential. All three of them, but I don't know, maybe it's obvious, but it wasn't obvious to me.
Or when you find your virtual temperature, this is acceptable.
I mean, somehow this shows that this idea that this is a genuine virtual temperature, to me it seems to add weight to this idea, because even if I use this virtual temperature and I couple it to a larger system, I still find that the state I generate appears to be a thermal state at the same temperature. It's not unique, it's not just an artifact of the fact that I tried to couple it to a two-level system. If I coupled it to any level system, I still get the behavior I want. So, and if I found that this wasn't the case, then I'd have to say, well, actually, maybe this wasn't really a virtual temperature. Maybe I was kidding myself.
Does the larger system have to have the right level spacing?
It would have to have a uniform spacing, each matching.
Matching.
Yes, this is the only requirement I have. Okay, so I see.
Because otherwise, there are more states.
There are more states, and I. So the problem I have is that then I always need this energies to match if this thing is to run in a stationary manner. So I need one machine for each energy gap. So I don't know a good way of viewing this at the moment.
My question is related to the feasibility of the population inversion by this scheme. From elementary laser physics, you know that it's not possible to get a population inversion by scheme, they could say. You need to have a three-level or four-level system. So because the probability of getting up are equal to the probability of going down, so permanently you cannot excite a two-level system make a population inversion. Unless you don't have some third or fourth level in which a population can go. So you can... You can never make a laser system work like you say, unless you make a more complicated system like do you understand what I mean?
I think this is related to the fact that I need the four levels here to get the inversion on
you
two
need
of them.
Three or four levels.
And actually, we can go to three, in which case you get a system which looks very much like a laser. So the
monic oscillator does not work.
It doesn't work?
No, because it does not have a term level. Because the probability of getting up with the ladder is equal to the probability of getting down. So you don't excite the upper level. Okay. So you have to go up, go to another level, and the relaxation time is as long, you can have population inversion. Like in the Ruby laser, you need a third level.
This machine actually has four levels.
He's just saying the virtual picture of like two levels of operation. Yes, but the work is, as far as I see, has been done on the harmonic oscillator ladder, no?
But I used my four-level system to do work on this, to continuously excite this harmonic oscillator.
So you go back, you go in the other level, okay?
Just to follow up on Eliezer's question, that seems to me to probably be right, that in the language of passivity, it's not having a non-passive system which is required for doing work, but any system that's not completely passive.
Okay, yes.
It can be used to do work, and complete passivity coincides with being a Gibbs state.
But
I think it's true that any non-thermal system will, in that literature, any non-thermal system can be used to do work.
I thought I was reading this theorem that said that a non-passive state is exactly one which... Oh, no, okay.
I see. An inversion.
Yeah, exactly, okay.
You might have to give yourself external control parameters and so on.
I agree with that, I think you're right.
Which I think they're not willing to do.
And I also think the second comment is that I think this, the failure to be a thermal state and yet still able to do work will also explain how you can get work with the Sillard engine, because I suspect the Sillard engine will be an example where you don't have a failure of passivity, but you have a failure of complete passivity.
Okay, that's...
This is just a follow-up random, unsubstantiated thought on cycles. But you really need the third level. It's playing a role somehow, doesn't it?
Yes.
You can reduce the four to three, you said, and still get them.
Yeah, in which case
so won't you see cycles there? In other words, going from the lower state to the highest state, then back to the middle state. Something like that, driven by the interaction.
Driven by
with
the environment, they'll have exactly this idea that when you really look at what's going on, there will be cycles. I agree. Yes. Yeah.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank you for the